Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
You're listening to the Laugh Button Podcast on the Riotcast Network, riotcast.com.
Welcome to another episode of the Laugh Button Podcast. I'm your host and your editor-in-chief of thelaughbutton.com, Matt Kleinschmidt, and I'm here with Bram Teitelman, editor-in-chief of metalinsider.net, our sister site.
Yeah.
And we also
I think it's a brother site, actually, if you want
your
to
your brother
that.
Site? Yeah. We'll be bros. I think sister works. And then we also have a very special guest, Brittany Brave, from the Laugh Button Metal Insider Hybrid. Sure.
From everything. Under the sun.
She was supposed to be with us last week, but she could not make it. It was also her birthday last week.
That's so why kinda, I couldn't so make
yeah,
it.
That's exactly what it is. Because you have a life.
Well, yeah, it's a national holiday.
Oh, that's what it was?
One more year of life. And it was also the day that Beyonce twins, so.
Yeah, it was Beyonce twin announcements. Which, by the way, you have a special kindred thing for Beyonce.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, there were two big announcements on my birthday 2 years in a row. I mean, I knew it all along, but now just the rest of
the world.
They're
both Beyonce announcements.
They were.
What was the first one?
Formation. She released her single and announced Lemonade and the world tour.
Oh, okay.
Felt personal, but I didn't want to overthink it. And then this year, two bundles of joy. I mean,
by the way, can we talk about the photo for a second? Like, it's fucking ridiculous, right?
Yeah, there's that internet meme going around of like Deb from Napoleon Dynamite creative directed the shoot.
Oh, I haven't seen this.
Oh, no? Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense.
Well, now you have two bundles of joy again, me and Matt.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Good.
I feel like Beyonce.
Yeah. So welcome to the podcast, Brittany Brave. This is your first time. Bram, you're an old hat at this point.
I'm very old.
And Mark actually continues his furlong.
Hi, Mark.
Where's he at this year, this week? He's in India?
He's in, yes. Not Indiana, India.
Oh, Indiana, India. I kind of picture Mark, when he takes time off, to be sitting on the back of, like, Falcor from The NeverEnding Story. Basically, Mark is Atreyu because he looks like a boy, and he also has the haircut as well. So Mark is Atreyu in my mind when he's on these vacations and these furlongs.
Whenever he does anything, I imagine him having a cape on. Like, even if he's like, oh, I tuned into the Grammys last night.
Wearing my cape.
I'm actually imagining him watching The NeverEnding Story on his couch with a cape on.
By the way, that movie fucked me up as a kid. I don't know if like you guys have watched the show.
I have not.
You've never seen The NeverEnding Story?
I have.
No, but I welcome spoilers.
Oh my God. First of all, it's a
spoiler alert. It ended.
Spoiler alert.
No way.
It did.
Other spoiler alert, the movie's 30 years old, so I don't know if that really works.
Okay.
It was a big movie as a kid, and it basically is a kid reading a book about a story, and then he's reading the story, and like there's this imaginary dragon beast lion thing called Falcor,
okay,
who flew in the sky. He's very serpentine. And there was the main guy, was Atreyu, and Atreyu was like, what, 12, 13? He was a young kid.
Sure.
And he was reading about it, and like he was like trying to, what was he trying to do? I remember he was trying to get to a castle, and he had to do basically a series of tests, and while the nothing was coming, the nothing was basically just this big void that would, like, eat you.
Black hole.
Yeah. You gotta watch. I can't believe you've never seen The NeverEnding Story. I know you're younger than me, but, like, it's a classic.
I was gonna say, when you're like, well, this was really popular when I was a kid, I'm like, I think all three of us have been kids at different times.
We absolutely have been kids at different times.
Argue that?
Could be, yeah.
Also, you're just saving me a lot of time by speeding up the NeverEnding Story process.
No, but you should watch it, because it's really good. First of all, when you're, like, 10 and like, his... spoiler, his horse dies.
Out of all the things
all
to
Texas.
Ruin.
Yeah. You well, want to see it now, don't you?
Yeah.
Dead horse. Yeah. I'm in. Well, what a great kid story.
Well, because it's a big thing. Because like Artex dies. He goes, Artex, you're sinking. Because he like dies in like, what is it? Quicksand? Mud? What is he dying, Bram?
I haven't seen it since I was a kid.
Yeah, but you know the show. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but it's been years. That could be a whole other podcast.
I don't know how we got on the topic
about movies
of the,
we haven't seen.
I don't know how
years.
We got on the topic of the NeverEnding Story.
Why yeah, do sure. I feel like this is one of those movies that no matter who you ask, the plot is completely different?
It's not. It's just I'm bad at explaining
I
the plot to
him
you.
Riding that thing.
Yeah, Falcor.
Yeah,
Atreyu riding Falcor, and then yeah. The kid wrote it at the end of it because it was and, like it was the shit. It was a big. It was very 80s. Like. like someone who wrote it definitely did cocaine. Like it was definitely like when you're watching like what are those guys get HR Puff and stuff. Like you're like these guys are fucking on mushrooms as they're writing children.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, not Rankin Bass. Rankin Bass did the stop motion Rudolph stuff.
They were on cocaine. All that snow.
Jesus Christ. Sid and Marty Krofft is who I'm thinking of for HR Puff and stuff. Not fucking cocaine. Jesus Christ.
It's a great podcast we're doing so far.
I don't know how we got off topic, but I'm going to reset. Reset. Here we go. The Laugh Button Podcast on the Riotcast Network. Let's announce who we have as a guest today. How about we do that?
Sure.
It's comedian Harrison Greenbaum. Mark and I went into Harrison's house and did a great interview with Harrison. Harrison's a comedian who's currently opening for Gad Emelah, who's the quote-unquote French Jerry Seinfeld. Gad's great. He actually has a new Netflix special that just came out. And Harrison, as I go back to him, he's a comedian. He's a magician. He used to write for Mad Magazine. He's this great backstory. We go into all the details. I was dying to ask him one question, but I didn't want to torpedo the whole interview, but I basically asked him about his obsession with Escape the Rooms. I knew this. I was like, oh, so I hear you're... And the funny thing is, we as a company are doing an Escape the Room as like a, you know, a culture fun fest type of thing. So I was like, I need to get pointers from this guy about Escape the Rooms. So,
well, now we know if you're out of the room in 0.2 seconds.
Basically, I've just been texting Harrison, hey, did you do this room? Yeah, find this, because I have a feeling Harrison's going to help me cheat. That's my ace in the hole. Hopefully no one else listens to this, because Harrison's going to help me win at our fucking fun club.
I have two thoughts. One, I hope that I'm on your team.
Okay.
And two, I'm already plotting how to escape this room.
Shit. Bram, you know what's funny? Is every time we do things like this, you high always... don't high-five him on that fucking terrible joke.
We're on the same team.
By the way, Bram, for some reason, every time we do these things and run in the office, you end up on my team. And there's always a balance. Either it's something you're tremendously great at and I'm shitty at, or vice versa.
Yeah.
Like when we go bowling, I'm a half-decent bowler. And Bram, you're the worst fucking bowler
There was a period of time where we just did a lot of bowling as these company activities.
And Bram's terrible at it.
I got better and better and still sucked majorly.
He almost cracked triple digits.
My entire team kicked me off of the team. That's how bad I was. Like quintessential bowling.
Yeah.
I think when all the other kids were bowling, I was watching The Never Ending Story and forgetting about it.
Stop being an asshole.
I'm trying to bring it back.
I know. So comedy news. So Harrison Greenbaum is our guest on the podcast this week. I keep resetting. Every 5 minutes, I'll just reset the podcast. There we go. Harrison Greenbaum is our guest, and we'll get to that interview in a bit. But let's go over some of the headlines this week. Big fucking week for SNL, guys.
Yes.
I feel like 30 things broke up so our story wise from SNL, all basically stemming from this week's episode where Kristen Stewart hosted, but no one's talking about Kristen Stewart hosting SNL because she almost just kind of was a byproduct of the whole episode.
Yeah, she kind of got swallowed by all the other spinning plates.
But Tatinas. Yeah, she did do the Tatinas
sketch.
Do not forget the Tatinas.
Never forget Tatinas.
Can't forget.
But Kristen Stewart kind of has always had this kind of like too cool for school kind of persona, and like it definitely plays off in this. Actually, she didn't really kind of, I don't want to say she didn't embrace hosting, because you have to embrace hosting to even want to host, unless you're Steven Seagal, who was like notoriously bad. I just feel like...
Or Trump.
She just wasn't she wasn't front and center, and all the memorable sketches save for a Totino's sketch she wasn't really the center of, like Melissa McCarthy's bit about her doing Sean Spicer literally set the world on fire. Rightfully so. It was an unbelievable sketch. She comes in basically spoofing White House press correspondent press coordinator.
Unbelievable impression too, equally spot on and equally just her own at the same time.
To mention the fact that it wasn't announced and people didn't even really know that it was her at first.
If you notice the applause, there's a primary applause and then there's a secondary applause, and people go, actually Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah, yeah.
And Sean Spicer actually found, like, people, he said his phone blew up and people are like, what the fuck is going on? And he thought something like a travesty happened.
He thought it was like a national emergency.
Like there was some sort of like a national emergency, because he was in church when the text message.
Oh, there is a national emergency going on right now.
Listen, last week was the political podcast, buddy. And this week, no politics.
Is the never-ending story.
Is the never-ending story of politics. But yeah, it's crazy because she did this and everyone's kind of raving. And Melissa McCarthy, like... She reminds me of Chris Farley, because there's not much physical comedy on SNL these days, save for every once in a while Beck Bennett will do stuff. But for the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, ever since kind of like Tina Fey took over, it's been way more of a writer's kind of SNL.
Yeah.
The last big I mean, you know, physical humor, personal on SNL, I want to say it was maybe like a Will Ferrell. It's probably the closest thing. Yeah. And Melissa McCarthy approaches it with like, she was like Farley, you know, it's like her doing her Matt Foley impression almost.
Yeah. And even on terms of like an energy level too, like the cast hasn't seen someone who has that like bullet like energy since probably like a Sherry O'Terry or something.
You know? Cocaine.
Well, you can't say that on this.
Today's Lap Button Podcast is brought to you by the drug cocaine.
I'm not saying Sherry O'Terry did cocaine, but I'm saying like Chris Farley, you know, he dabbled in a few different drugs. Cocaine might have been one of them.
And he's not a selfish guy. No, so
he might have shared. So, right. Melissa McCarthy does this impersonation of Sloan Spicer. Everyone fucking loves it, save for our president in chief, Donald Trump.
He didn't like it either, actually. He was like,
I'm saying.
No, I mean, Spicer was like...
Well, Spicer kind of laughed it off the way a politician should.
But then he was like, it got mean. The show got really mean.
But he said, he didn't say his impersonation got mean. He said Alec Baldwin's impersonation of the president got mean. That's what he said.
So it just means it got real.
Yeah, basically.
Realer than ever.
But I do think, I mean, a few things have happened, though. But, like, the ratings just came out this morning that SNL's ratings have not been this high in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, clearly, they've tapped onto some sort of zeitgeist. I mean, 20 years, that's even talking about they've beat the ratings of 2008 when Tina Fey did the whole Sarah Palin stuff, too.
What show or anything, any band or artist or anything... wouldn't want the president being like, hey, this sucks. Don't watch this. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Well, I know. That's the funny thing.
What could possibly go wrong?
And if you listen to Lorne Michaels in any interview, like he wanted it to be this cult rebellious comedy that kind of shook everything up when he kind of created it.
Well, yeah. It was the show of the counterculture when it first started. But it hasn't really been the counterculture in a long time.
No, it went through a brief period of time where it was very internet trend friendly.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, they had to make that transition to, like, that was around the time of Andy Samberg and The Lonely Island where they had to kind of make that transition. So, I mean, I think that was actually very important for them. But I think, I don't know if they still feel like they're responsible in some way for quote unquote normalizing Trump. They get a lot of shit about normalizing Trump by having him on the show last year. But I think that it's kind of found, okay, we can definitely, these are some establishment people we can kind of still poke holes in. And we talked about this last week briefly about, like, you know, when that person appears on the show, it no longer becomes funny, you know. So, like, I like when they don't have politicians on the show. They don't have the celebrity they're mocking on the show.
And now it's really funny because it's actually really getting under the president's skin.
Well,
he's sitting around watching SNL. Like on a Saturday night, he's actually sitting around watching it.
I don't know. I mean, but
so at least we know for that 1 hour and a half, everything's okay.
Yeah.
No buttons are being pressed.
Yeah, nothing's exploding.
I guess so. But so the Sean Spicer thing happened. And the other thing that really kind of got under his crawl about it was the fact that it was a woman portraying Sean Spicer. I don't know if you heard this, Brittany. But like Trump literally got mad because...
I did.
He said he's like a woman was portraying a man. And he got pissed at Spicer for this.
And somehow I'm not surprised that would be his gut reaction his Achilles whatsoever. Heel. Yeah. But I mean, just to, you know, redirect it back to Melissa McCarthy, I mean, it's that gender ambiguous comedy too that she has as well that you gotta pat her on the back for. But that
or grab her and forget it.
Hey, stop.
Yeah. Oh, excuse.
I stopped.
She grabbed that impression by the tiny hands. By its tiny little hands.
You know what? And Melissa McCarthy had a great weekend because she had that Super Bowl commercial about the Kia commercial about saving the trees and saving the rain. Like, she had a really great weekend. And the funny thing about it was I actually just watched Boss for the first time that Saturday.
Yeah.
So I saw her in Boss, which, by the way, underrated. Great movie if you haven't seen it. Her in Boss.
I've not.
She's great. It's exactly what you'd expect from a Melissa McCarthy movie. So I watched Boss, laughed at that for 2 hours with my wife, fast forward an hour or two, SNL, and she's on SNL, and then she's doing a Super Bowl. So, like, I just did nothing but pay attention to Melissa McCarthy all weekend.
Yeah.
So.
Not the worst thing.
No, not at all. But so Trump gets mad that a woman portrays one of his cabinet members. Now, I personally.
Allegedly.
Well, that's
there's just leaks coming all over.
This is true. The leaks are coming. That's something.
I'm not talking about the ones that take place in Russian hotel rooms.
But he's also been. It sounds like Spicer wasn't his first call, his first choice for that position. So I think he kind of doesn't like Spicer to begin with.
Yeah.
Spicer was like kind of like pushed upon him by Reince Priebus. So he's looking to like kind of wage any kind of war he can.
Yeah, poke holes wherever he can.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
I also think he thinks it's a weird. Defense of his cabinet by saying something like that.
Well, I think the way that man is he doesn't like the look weak in public, and if people in his cabinet look weak, he therefore looks weak. I think that's what it is.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But With that being said, people suggested, like John Fugelsang and a couple other comedians suggested, like
Rosie.
They said a woman should do it. And then someone said, hey, Rosie should do it, because Rosie and Trump had this feud years ago when she was on The View. And Rosie basically said, yeah, I'll fucking do it.
Yeah, she said, like, whenever the time comes, I'm there.
I think her exact words were like, I'll serve if called or something.
Called,
like,
yeah. Yes.
I mean, she already got like referenced in a debate.
Yeah,
you know,
she did.
Back all the shit he talked
and
about her.
Yeah, because it's funny because this week Steve Bannon appeared on the show, but he appeared as the Grim Reaper in the cold opening. So they don't really have a quote unquote Bannon in there yet. But with Alec Baldwin hosting this weekend, who's done Trump for the last 6 months or so, it very well could be. It would be great if like Melissa McCarthy, Alec Baldwin, and Rosie O'Donnell show up and just kind of do a whole cabinet cold open type of great.
I would watch the whole show. That should just be the whole show.
So
and it would probably be the if you're saying that it's had its biggest ratings in 20
years.
Yeah,
its biggest ratings in 20 years.
This Saturday is probably the weekend to watch.
I think it is the weekend to watch. And going back to Kristen Stewart and the whole episode, the episode felt edgy for the first time in a long time. First of all, she drops an F-bomb during her monologue.
Yes.
Completely accidentally.
I'm not fully convinced. The rebel was a little orchestrated.
It's highly possible.
Yeah.
So there's that, and there's the whole Weekend Update flubs, where, like, you know, basically Michael Che flubbed the joke, redid the joke. Colin Jost came out of the piece with Kenan Thompson, like, almost ending Weekend Update, and they're like, hey, there's a whole other segment. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Melissa McCarthy thing, the cold open. Like, for the first time, it felt like it was a live show. Like, the show's always been live, but, like, it really felt live this
week. Here's the thing,
like, first time in a while.
I'm probably not alone in this, but I don't watch it. I don't DVR it. I'll just wait to see what's on. The highlights the next day.
Yeah.
And I watched the news. I watched the cold open. I watched the Melissa McCarthy thing. Mm-hmm. I watched the Totino's thing. And I watched the the FAA Airlines thing. And I was I just watched about 35 minutes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
With ads out and musical guests, like, I probably watched about over half the show.
Yeah.
And if over half the show was relevant and I watched it and I was entertained by it like I was, that's something.
Yeah.
That's saying something.
I think it's also worth mentioning too, and it kind of goes back about a minute or so here, about SNL's move into digital and the digital shorts and how that was such a necessary thing.
They needed to.
The political commentary for SNL, though, 9 times out of 10, they always keep that to the live sketches, which I think is important. You know, very, very seldom, or at least they're really strategic whenever they decide to make one of those politically charged skits, something that you can watch over and over again and on a digital short, roll it out that way. And it kind of echoes your point that there was this fire to the show, this organic, who knows what's going to happen. It is live. It is sketch comedy. It is hit or miss.
Yeah, it felt like that for the first time in a long time. It was very like the live thing. And unfortunately, it was Kristen Stewart, because I think she worked better in the pre-recorded bits. The two bits were Totino's and the, what was the other bit she did? The Meet Cute bit with Pete Davidson. So like those felt like more her. But for the first time in a long time, the show felt live. It was actually really cool. So I'm curious to see what they do this weekend. And then the final thing that came out of SNL this weekend is the thoughts of NBC turning Weekend Update into a weekly show, into a once a week half hour show like on Thursday nights.
Finally, all my incessant letter writing and protesting, they're listening. Thank you, NBC. It took you long enough.
All right.
I'm a fan.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah. Well, SNL has done the specials. Like, they'll do like the Thanksgiving special, and they'll show like an hour of all their favorite Thanksgiving sketches, Christmas and Easter and Valentine's Day. But this will actually be a new half hour. They did an hour previously for the election, but this will be like literally like almost like a Samantha Bee or John Oliver type of show every Thursday night.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I think like just for comedy, you know, it's kind of creating content that's mimicking exactly or kind of responding to whatever the consumer wants and needs. So even if it doesn't become this permanent fixture in SNL history, that's totally okay. Mm-hmm. At least for the next handful of years or however long, like there's a demand for it.
Yeah.
I think they have enough problems filling up like a consistently funny 10 minutes on the show personally.
Really? Okay.
I don't know. I think there's enough better places to get, a weekly burst of whatever, be it John Oliver or Samantha Bee. I think that they're really covering Daily Show.
Yeah.
I think there's enough out there. And
you do? Okay.
If they made it monthly, I think it'd be great.
Okay.
I could oversaturate. I could see them repeating stuff.
Yeah, it always kind of felt like an a la carte own variety comedy show to me, though. It did. It felt like something that kind of always had its own breed, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, well, Update usually has its own writers. Yep. So, like, you know, there's the main writers and there's people that kind of just focus on Update. I also think that if they were to do it, the question is, like, do you take the anchors from the Saturday show and put them on Thursday as well and have the same people writing for it? So, I mean, like, Lorne Michaels has enough clout at NBC. I mean, shit, he practically owns NBC between producing SNL, producing a variety show of some sort in the summer, mm-hmm. and then producing Seth Meyers and the Tonight Show.
His nice little SNL empire.
Yeah. He's got him in Broadway Video, and then he also has the web version with Above Average and all that stuff. So, I mean, like, he definitely has an empire and clout to do whatever the hell he wants to do. And NBC, he has long enough of a track record with NBC that they'll let him do whatever he wants. But I also think that he'll do it smartly if he does it at all. So it's just interesting. That I personally think it's a good thing for NBC, because if you think about it, Seth Meyers is doing really well with his, like, political, a closer look type of stuff. Jimmy Fallon doesn't touch that shit as far as politics.
He touches Trump's hair.
But in fact, also back on the ratings tip, since the inauguration of Trump, Colbert has flipped and has actually taken over Fallon as the top late night guy.
Really?
Because Colbert has taken it straight to Trump with all that kind of stuff. So this might be their answer to that, of like, hey, we can keep Fallon as it is, as this little, like, cottage variety show, which I think does very well and there's an audience for that. But it's like, okay, well, how do we attack politics in a humorous way? Because there's no one doing that on NBC other than SNL's Weekend Update. And I think it's a good thing.
I guess there's that. And it is good for comedy. I mean, what's NBC really have? I mean, they have that.
Well, NBC's new comedy, Powerless, is pretty good. I mean, like, yeah, they used to have must-see TV on Thursday.
Yeah,
nights.
Now it's like might-see TV.
But I mean, like, NBC, I mean, like, the track record of NBC for Thursday night sitcoms for years in the 80s and 90s. I mean, from The Cosby Show to Friends, all the way up to, like, Frasier and all that stuff. Well, that was all NBC.
If you were going to watch any handful
Parks and Rec, The Office, all that stuff.
Primetime comedies, it was always going to be NBC Thursday night. That's what you know.
So maybe that's their attempt to get back into that game. I mean, like, they abandoned it one whole year. Like, I think two seasons ago or last season. Literally, it was just all hour dramas. They weren't doing any more comedy in that time slot. I think it's cool that they're actually kind of turning back towards comedy. So I think it's cool.
All right, you changed my mind. I'll be there for it. That was a Friends reference, guys.
No more flip-flopping.
But I think, John Oliver returns this week. And you have John Oliver, and he's been trying to not make it all about Trump, his show. And I like it when John takes on a longer-form topic. So I think John Oliver is doing his own thing. Trevor Noah is really coming into his own. And Samantha Bee is doing great, too. They're putting her on now middle of the week instead of the beginning of the week. So I think it kind of makes sense for SNL to do it before CBS has its version, or there's the ABC version of it, too.
That's true.
And John Oliver said he was going to stay away from Trump, but I don't know if he's going to be able to. Like, he spent so much time on it and does such a great job skewering him.
Yeah, it's tough. It's definitely going to be tough. I mean, but at the same time, it's like he only has so many hours of the week, you know, versus...
It's a half hour.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. He's got one half hour during the week. Trevor Noah's got, what, two full hours because he's Monday through Thursday. He's a half hour piece. So he's got 2 hours to talk about some other shit, too.
There's also a lot of different ways, especially from a comedic perspective, that you can attack Trump or cover Trump
politics
as well, too.
Or anything like that.
Yeah,
very much so. So, okay, so sticking on the late night spot, we're going to jump over to TBS, Conan. Do you guys hear about Conan's story?
What's scandalous. Going
on? It's like an old lawsuit, right?
Basically, what happened was in 2015, actually, the jokes are about Tom Brady jokes.
Ironically.
From the last Super Bowl. So not the one he just won, his fifth. It was from his fourth victory as a Super Bowl.
Yep.
So that was like 2 years ago?
Yep.
Basically, there's a guy who runs a blog, and there's a lot of guys out there. So they basically write late-night monologues. They put them on their blogs. I know plenty of examples of blogs that do this. People just kind of like, oh, let me see if I can write some jokes. Letterman, when he was on the air, used to have people submit jokes, and like if they make it to the air, he'll tell it, and you'll get like a little bit of compensation. There's plenty of people that write that kind of stuff. But he writes a blog, and he basically wrote a couple of these Tom Brady stories, about five of them in total, and he's accusing Conan of stealing them, taking them for his monologue a couple years back. And he basically pressed a lawsuit again. And Conan, being the comedy titan that Conan is, Conan's accusing a comedian of stealing a joke is like
the worst thing.
Next to murder, it's the worst thing you can accuse a comedian of doing. So he's like fighting it back. He's like, I don't want anyone thinking that we steal jokes.
I mean, from my seat, it's the internet. It's free information. It's so many things that are circulating, and no idea is really original. I mean, maybe you guys are more briefed on it than I am, but is there any direct track
that's the basis. That's the basis of Conan's argument. He basically kind of filed a countersuit saying just because it was posted online doesn't mean that someone from his camp found it.
Right.
Posting it online isn't your claim of a copyright of an idea.
Right.
So he's like that, and the idea is basically like when you have jokes, you can obviously copyright jokes, or jokes are become yours. But like the premise that Tom Brady is a Super Bowl victor,
it's a little common.
Well, the punchline is usually what makes it unique. The premise and the setup can be anything. It's like airline food. How many fucking comedians have jokes about airline food? That's the premise, not the punchline.
And all of them are hysterical, too.
Oh, I guess they are. So Conan basically fired back with, like, him, his writers, his production company. They basically all, like, filed this thing saying, like, no, this isn't how it works. And in the law, in the countersuit, he basically breaks down how they write the monologue, which is kind of interesting to see the creative process.
Yeah.
But it basically says, this is why we have the monologue created like this. So it prevents joke thievery, or it also doesn't encourage writers to steal jokes. Basically, it says, in the morning, everyone kind of sits down for an hour and a half, and writes like general ideas. They kind of hone them for grammar, send them in. They get some notes from Conan and his immediate team. They send them back. They punch them a little bit, and they go back. And there's a couple back and forths in this process. By like 3 or 4 o'clock is when they start like actually shape the monologue.
Yeah.
And it's all done anonymously, which is interesting. And I think anonymously is what helps. The reason it's done anonymously is so no one sits there and think, oh my God, I only had one joke up that made it through a monologue last week.
It's not
my
really job's about credit.
At stake. Yeah. Well, it also helps alleviate that need for a comedian to be like, I gotta find a joke.
Yeah.
And just kind of write creatively and think. So Conan's like, I'm not basing that on your merit. And that's Conan's way of saying, there's no reason to steal because no one knows who wrote this joke anyway. It's just this pool of joke writers. So,
and it kind of seems like everybody takes a stab at editing it or refining it, and they kind of pass it back and forth.
Yeah, I think the key to that victory for him will be that anonymousness of the jokes, is the fact that, like, you know, it's like there's no need to steal because your job's not at stake.
Or even being as candid as he is about his entire joke writing process on his show, too. I mean, that's something that as a comedian, too, you kind of hold that close to your vest.
Yeah,
no matter
absolutely.
What kind of comedy you do. You know, I have my own kind of warm-ups. I have my own way that I generate ideas, that I craft a joke, or I write a sketch. So him being that willing on the platform that he is and the status that he is to say, like, not only this is why I didn't plagiarize, let me like let you into like the makings of my entire program.
Interesting. It is interesting. I mean, because all comedians, their process is different. I know some comics never write shit down. Some guys have flashcards. Some guys have books. Some guys have recorders and
some
voice recording.
Half improvised.
Some sit down and like, I need to write for the next hour or two. Some like, I write on stage. You know, it just kind of happens.
The suit has not been settled yet, right?
No, basically it's in the hands of the judge right now. And they basically count. They didn't counter sue, but they basically are taking a preemptive strike for the lawsuit saying this guy is full of shit. They're also saying this guy said, I'm cool and I won't sue you if you offer me a job. And they said no.
That's a bullshit.
So that's where it gets, that's where it's like, all right, well, they didn't want to hire your ass, so now you're actually going through the lawsuit.
It sounds like he told them he was suing them through LinkedIn.
I think the lawsuit's going to leave him very deflated. What?
Deflate
cake.
It was a joke because the Patriots and
Jesus Christ, man.
We get it.
Bring it to a...
I'm doing double duty here on the soundboard, too. Oh, man.
I know. Jeez, I know, I know. So, I don't know how to recover from that, so good work on that. So
that's why we're here.
Good work on that. So, yeah, a few things are happening that are just kind of, like, really interesting. Like, I mean, the Super Bowl, you guys got any thoughts on, like, funny commercials this year or anything like that?
I thought they were duds.
I thought they were.
It was amazing how unfunny they were.
You know what's funny with the Super Bowl? And, like, someone said this a long time ago, and I don't know who to give credit to. It definitely was not me that came up with
it. It was me. It was probably me.
Okay, yeah, it was Brittany Brave. Mm-hmm. Brittany Brave, everyone. It was basically saying, like, usually, like, you know, oh, the game's really good and the commercials are terrible, or the game's terrible and the commercials are really good.
Yeah, like yin and yang a little bit. Yeah,
I mean, like, it definitely was like America, and we're diverse people. It was like,
and hey, here's a ghost dog.
Is that the best we can do?
Poor Spuds McKenzie.
We are really doomed.
The ghost of Spuds McKenzie. For fuck's sake. Yeah, there were some good ones in there, but the whole message was about, it seemed very about inclusion and all that kind of stuff. And unfortunately, you know, usually messages of positivity and patriotism don't really kind of relate for humor, I guess. So I thought some of the stuff was funny. The ghost dog, I was more like, oh, cool, that's Spuds McKenzie. And that was like my response to that. It wasn't like, oh, this is hilarious. It was just, oh, Spuds McKenzie, they're bringing him back.
Well, I think to like tie it kind of back, which is why SNL is doing as incredibly stupid well as it is, I think people are still looking for comic relief.
Of
and
course.
I mean, the message of inclusion and taking the excuse to spread that around, absolutely, it's totally necessary. But Super Bowl commercials, I want something silly.
Yeah, you kind of want it to be dumb and silly. But, you know, I mean, there was a lot of, like, it seemed like the commercials that went for the joke were, like, about, like, those, like, mobile video games, like Tank Strike and all
this. Yeah.
Where you're just like, what? Maybe I just don't, because I don't play those games. I have no idea how to rate them or form them in my head. But it's just like, I don't care. I don't know.
I mean, I guess we can technically consider like the first 30 seconds of Lady Gaga's performance to be one of the Super Bowl commercials as well, too.
Sure.
I do in my head.
Well, before, up until when she jumped and then it became live.
Right. And the shades of the sky were vastly different in darkness.
Well, apparently the reason they did that was because of weather, obviously.
Yeah.
You can never predict it. But the other thing was also because of the drones.
Yeah.
The whole backdrop was done with drones. Two dudes and a laptop. That's who ran that whole like backdrop, like 50 some drones or something like that. Powered by it's like an Intel drone squad that did this shit.
Oh my god!
But apparently, because of the no-fly zone they have over the Super Bowl, during the Super Bowl, they couldn't put these drones in the air and do it live.
So those guys are like magnets right now. Yeah.
No-fly zone. I saw Lady Gaga fly through the air.
Yeah, oh,
was she clear?
All right, I'm getting the fuck off of that.
what?
I took it there. Yeah. I took it there, and I happily took it there.
Before we kick this to the Harrison interview, a couple things too. The Comedy Town at Bonnaroo was announced this year. Another stellar lineup: Hannibal Buress at
Improvised Shakespeare Company.
Yeah, are you familiar with them?
Yes, and I'm a massive fan.
Okay, cool. So you're psyched about this?
Yes, I am. I'm kind of cool to see them in like a festival setting. Well, I haven't seen them in a festival setting personally. I haven't, but yeah.
I've never been to a comedy stage at a gigantic music festival.
The Bonnaroo tent does it right, and the reason they do it right is because, first of all, it's fucking hot as shit down there. You're in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. It's probably, I feel like every year it's like 95 plus temperature wise, and they have a giant tent. It's air conditioned. It's somewhat soundproof because you need to kind of be relatively quiet.
Sure.
So it's a good place to kind of go in there, sit down, catch some cool air, seek refuge a little bit from the whole thing. So, like, over the years past, I mean, they've had everyone from, like, you know, Judah Friedlander, Ari Shaffir, Jay Ogerson, all those types of guys, Soder, Mark Norman, all those guys have done it. And then this year they have, who else is there? Like, Two Dope Queens is doing it, which is Phoebe Robinson and Jessica Williams.
Yep.
So, like, that's
Sam Morrill.
Yeah, Sam Morrill's down there, too. Mike Lawrence is doing it this year. So, really good lineup on the Comedy Tent. We have the full lineup on thelaughbun.com. And Bridgetown also announced its 10-year anniversary. I can't believe Bridgetown's been around 10 years. And they're doing a pre-show with Patton Oswalt, who was one of the original guys that did Bridgetown. So it's kind of cool to see.
What do we get them for that? A birdhouse? Is that what you give a 10 years?
What is a 10-year anniversary? First year is paper, because I just had my first year anniversary. Yeah. 10 years, is it 10 years like...
Second year is paper cuts. I will not be invited back.
Tin, maybe?
Going out with a bang.
Tin? Aluminum? I don't know. I don't know. Okay. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to cut to the Harrison Greenbob interview, and then we're going to come back. We're going to wrap this fucker up. How about that?
I'm sorry, guys.
Sounds good.
Here it is, our interview with Harrison Greenbob.
Yeah. All right, Matt, we're back. Another episode of the Laugh Button Podcast.
We're here.
Here we are. We're live, and we're still alive, and we're still alive. All right, it's happening. It's all happening.
You have the shittiest intros. I can't stand
them. I'm trying to make them worse every single time.
I know. You do it deliberately to fuck with me.
It helps. It just helps make us look better.
I guess.
In photos. All right. So Harrison Greenbaum is our guest. He's joining us. And Harrison is somebody who I go way back
with. He doesn't have
shit
intros.
Yeah, that's very true. But I go pretty far back with this guy. I don't know if he even remembers this, but I met him as an usher at the Alternative Comedy Festival up in Boston in 2006.
Something around there, yeah. Maybe. Brian Joyce was running that thing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so this is 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I ran into this guy. He's like, "Oh, hey, you're a flyer. You know, you're a flyer." I'm like, "Yeah, sure, I'll take it." And we ended up talking for a little bit. And I was like, "You know, what's your deal?" Because you were like by far the happiest person there. And you were so excited to be a part of it all. And I was like, "This guy's odd. Like, this is the kind of guy I want to be friends with. Somebody's super happy." And you were just telling me, like, "Man, comedy, it's my thing. I want to be in it. Like, you're just, if I'm not doing it on a set, I want to be helping someone who is." And you were so, like, just clear. You had a clear path to what you were going to be doing for the rest of your life. And I got that like instantly. And then we rode in there was no Uber back then, but I think we got in a cab together. At least I got back to my hotel that way, and you were definitely in the back seat.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember
a real
this.
Cab.
I don't know if you remember any of this.
I remember that
I don't
festival.
Forget this stuff. I mean,
my clearest memory, early memory of us was, now this sounds like a relationship.
Ah, it's totally fine. Okay.
No, it was the Andy Kaufman Awards, because you were doing the interviews, and I was a finalist. Mm-hmm. Or I had been a finalist the year before, and it was before I competed, and that year I ended up winning. So it was like right before. So I was like a nervous but excited mess.
That's true.
I remember that interview
that was
very well.
Serious. Yeah, sure. And then since then, he actually had me on a comedy show And it was my last set ever.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The last time I ever was on stage doing comedy was it called Bar 82 or something?
Yeah.
And it was Harrison hosted, and Al Jackson was there that night, Sam Morril.
Absolutely. Myself. It wasn't going to be his last set, but then I stood up and said, stop it forever.
End this. Do something else.
There were two lights in the back of the room. One was for his set, and one was for his career.
And he was strobing.
Well, so there's a funny backstory to that set, because earlier that day I had Bobby Collins up on my show, right? And then that comedy show was that night. I think it was a Tuesday night. Went out, performed, blah blah blah. When I got off stage, first person to come up to me was Bobby Collins. Said, "Hey man, hey, you know, good effort up there." I was like, "Oh god,
comedy."
Yeah, I was like, "Oh, good effort." I just hung my head. Then I was like, "Wait, Bobby, what the fuck are you doing here?" And he's like, "I don't know, I just go out and see comedy sometimes." And I was like, okay. And it was one of those weird, you know, serendipitous moments of just...
Yeah, Barty 2 was so fun. I did it with Sam Morril.
Mm-hmm.
We did it for 5 years. It was like one of the longest running independent shows for a while.
Sure.
And we had a blast with it. And then we reached a point where both of us were getting booked so much that we were losing stage time by producing a show. And that's right. When you go, okay,
yeah.
I can just start doing spots.
So is that the goal with it? Because a lot of comedians seem to do that, especially when they're on their way up in the career. You know, they try to find a room or grab a room, you know, like a Bar 82 or something that's not necessarily a traditional comedy.
Well, it was originally the Stage Theater, which is 7-Eleven 7th Avenue, mm-hmm. which is now LOL.
Right.
So it's come full circle.
I remember that. I remember
that
you.
Is now comedy again. But like, we were one of the first people to do stand-up when it was still this just like little theater. Hidden.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah.
So
but it's always good to produce a show.
Yeah, totally.
So fill us in between that alternative comedy fest up to Bar 82 in that moment in time, like everything that's happened with you, because the Coffin Award obviously is something that did take place, right?
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
What? It's a very long period of time you're giving him. Tell us about your entire life for this 10-year period.
No, because we know what's going on now.
Yeah, I know.
But there's a lot of holes that need to be filled, and that's why I'm asking him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You didn't ask me how I knew him.
Do you?
How do you know me?
You did a Laugh Button Live for us at Gotham Comedy Club, and you said you liked my shoes. End of introduction. Not these ones.
You probably had great shoes.
I did. And I was like, oh, Harrison likes my shoes. I told my wife
because
she had bought me the shoes, and she was really excited.
Nice.
That's my story.
I love this. Just turned into the, hey, Harrison, remember?
I wonder if I was.
How do you know Harrison's story?
I feel like I was probably working at Hot 97 because I was a story producer for their reality show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which means I helped them write. And
story producer.
I'm a comedy writer. And so... we would go into the office every day at Hot 97. Most security I've ever had to go through for a job. Because rappers would literally get shot.
Yeah, people have been shot.
People have been shot at Hot 97.
Have you witnessed a shooting? Did you witness
I've never
a shooting?
Witnessed it. The closest I came to a shooting, now I'm digressing, but I was a block away, very close to being shot. Because I was doing, I just done the, I just graduated Harvard. Mm-hmm. That was right after the
Alt Fest. Yeah.
And I was taking any stage time I could get. And I had my grandma's white Volvo it was a 91 Volvo. And I would drive it from my parents' house in Long Island to anywhere that had stage time.
Mm-hmm.
So I drove it to Coney Island in the middle of the week, which it can be a little bit dicey.
Yeah.
In the summer, it's fine. But on a random weekday in the winter, very dicey.
The Warriors is real.
So I drove it to some random bar and it was exposed in the back. So you were performing, but it was one of those garage door things where they could open it.
Oh, okay.
So your back is to the street, but somebody could literally just poke you in the back if they wanted, because there's nothing behind you but just air and the sidewalk.
Okay.
Which is weird because people are seeing the back of your head and hearing you talk about stuff as they're walking by. So people will stop and look in and you can't tell. So people are distracted because
the audience is doing this weird stuff.
So we hear a weird sound. Then we hear sirens and we're like, what's going on? And then I found out later that somebody had just been murdered. Somebody was just shot a block away from me. And my back was just to the open air. I was very close to murder. Very, very close to murder. It wasn't even there was a glass window protecting me from murder. It was, I was very near to it.
There was nothing to deflect or ricochet the murder.
There was no shielding.
It was just direct murder.
I was directly attached to murder.
You felt the breeze of the murder. Breeze coming off the murder.
And I remember making fun of all the sirens because we kept hearing police and stuff. So I was making fun of it. I guess I'm in a dangerous neighborhood. Ha ha ha. They were driving to the murder. That was right there. And then a homeless guy got into a fight with me because there was a garbage can right outside the window. And we just basically had a street fight because I'm on a stage, but there's no barrier. And he was going through the garbage and just yelling shit at me during my... It was a... That was...
That's great.
That was a crazy time.
What I feel like every comedian has those stories.
Great
those
gig.
Are great stories.
What a good.
Those
good
are my
gig.
Favorite.
Yeah, yeah, those are the ones you remember more than just like, you know, gig X at Club X.
That's like when you start dating somebody, I feel like they have in their head like, oh, you're going to do these like big theaters, yeah, or these gigantic, right, you know, like I've met a couple of girlfriends where like the first show they saw me is at the Cellar,
yeah,
and they see me like follow a Chris Rock and they're like, whoa, comedy's amazing.
Yeah, right.
And then I'm
right,
like, no, we got to go to Coney Island and
get knives thrown at our heads.
Yeah, so stand next to murder the whole time.
Yeah, that's way more common. It's not the sexy part. Like we have a fun job and everyone's yeah, like, oh, like, yeah, I'm not a comedian, but we like do entertainment stuff. And everyone's like, oh, you know, you have a really great job. It's like, yeah, but like, you know, you got like 8 hours of work before you get to go hang out in like a bar. And then like, by the time you're at the bar, you just want to go to
yeah,
bed.
You actually just want to go to bed.
Yeah, come yeah, Friday, all your friends want to go out. And you're just like, no, I've been out every night this week.
So, that was one of the most like eye-opening things was, and this can, I can connect back to the AltFest.
Okay,
so we
cool,
can get
us
there.
It.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So AltFest, I had founded the Harvard College Stand-Up Comic Society, which is Harvard College Sucks. That was the acronym. The dean's office had no idea. We never wrote out the acronym. We just like wrote the full name out every time.
So,
so by the time they approved us and gave us the stamp, we got an email like a while later being like, oh, now we get it. We're not happy about this, but we can't do anything about
it. You still have that paper? You still have
I still have that email.
Yes.
And then 5 years later at my first reunion, the 5-year reunion, a dean was just like, by the way, I couldn't tell you while you were a student, but like, a lot of us love that. Like, we thought it was the best thing that we've ever had stuck by us.
Oh,
like,
man.
The balls to try to do that. We loved it. And that group is still, it's celebrating its 10th anniversary.
Wow.
That's great.
Very cool.
Like, this month is the 10th anniversary of the club. And actually, I'm going to Boston tomorrow and meeting up with the current presidents to try to plan something out. And just, like, every time I go back to Boston, I try to, like, make myself available.
Sure.
Like, ruin the next generation. It's like every generation now there's like those kids who they went to Harvard, they did really well, and then they like meet up with me in a coffee shop and I'm like, so here's how you lose it all.
well but what a cool thing you're able to go back there and like you set a goal for yourself, you're achieving it, and then they get to see that, and like that's got to be super inspirational too.
Yeah.
like you're that guy, you know what I mean? You're
I'm
at the top
trying
of the food
so
chain.
Hard to be that guy. There's a lot of other, like, we have some really great alumni. Yeah, alumni. Yeah. That's always the plural.
Yeah.
Alexander Petri was the president after me with Megan Amram. Both
oh,
of
wow.
them are
yeah.
super successful.
Yeah, Megan. Totally.
Megan's
Amram's
writing doing. Right now for The Good Place.
Uh-huh.
And
books
Alex,
and yeah, Twitter,
and yeah, Alex has a great book, The Field Guide. I'll plug it. The Field Guide to Awkwardness. It's fantastic. But she's she's the only writer under 30 and a female that's like a fully full columnist at a major newspaper. So she's killing it.
Wow.
And then Nielsen,
and she has the best Twitter profile
remember, like,
shot of her
yeah,
doing
had, like,
the face with
the on her Twitter.
I mean, that's
yeah.
Megan. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Megan's killed. I mean, she killed it right out of the game.
She put out a book about science or something like
she
that.
She did.
From the yeah. Yeah.
She wrote for Parks and Rec, the yeah. Oscars.
God, so
and then
crazy.
We have Nelson Greaves, who wrote Unfriended, which was like a popular horror movie.
Yep.
He's been killing it.
Yeah, I watched
selling
that movie.
Stuff. And then my co-president was Dave Ingber, who's like working for SNL, basically with above average for
yeah,
their
yeah.
like sports website.
Wow.
So there's like, we're trying to build up a network. It's not as quite as extensive as like the Lampoon.
Yeah, of course.
But for 10 years in, I think we're
doing
all
right.
Okay.
I think most people just getting the degree. You could stop there. But speaking of which, I don't know if this is cool to say, but I'm staring at a wall here in a
yeah,
place we're recording
it.
This. And
Friars
it's
Club.
It's one of the most
well, I feel like I should explain some of
yeah,
the
amazing
things.
Comedy wall. But to start over on the left-hand side, like my left is the official Harvard University, you know,
diploma.
It looks almost too good that it looks like it could have been eBayed. But
although my mom, when she came, she literally goes, "Oh, you should hang that in the bathroom," which was at partially funny but partially painful.
That's kind of a thing.
She's like, "All right, if you're gonna be a comedian, you might as well hang it in the bathroom."
Yeah.
But isn't that a thing though? Like, well, I heard when, like if you're a musician and you make a gold record or an executive, you're supposed to hang your first one in the bathroom. It's
well,
actually like
weird.
Katie Couric, who I did warm up for her for a season, and
okay.
one of the things was they did like a house makeover episode.
Yeah.
So basically, the show paid to have somebody clean her house.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. Like,
yeah.
I would love that. But one of the things that they discovered when they went to her house was that one of her Emmys was just like on the toilet.
Yeah, you're supposed to do that apparently.
So like, they moved it into like a nice case. But like, could you imagine taking a shit and then there's just like an Emmy? That's the best.
I think
that's the ultimate expression.
Is it humbling? Is that what it is? Maybe
it's bad. I think it's badass. It's a mic drop, really.
Yeah,
it totally is.
I have so many Emmys once in my bathroom.
Oh man.
So we have
so we have
Friars Club right in the middle.
Yeah, we have so we have nine squares here.
Yeah.
You know, I guess we can get through this pretty quickly. But yeah, you have a Friars Club right in the middle there with your name on it. Great font, by the way. But it's surrounded by all these wonderful Mad Magazine posters and pictures, because that's someplace you worked, which we'll talk about in a minute. And the Academy of Magical Arts, Inc.
This is a real thing. That's the Magic Castle.
Okay.
So I'm the only magician currently who's a regular at the Cellar, which is like, I guess we consider the top comedy venue in the country. And then the Magic Castle, which is the top magic venue.
Oh, that's great.
So I was always dreamed of like just hanging out at the Magic Castle, because as like a kid, you're like, the castle is the greatest.
Yeah.
And then when I was 18, they let me go in, even though I wasn't 21. I had to wear a big badge, like a yellow badge saying that it's under 21.
Don't look at me. Don't touch me. Not, yeah.
I always had this dream.
Could they have got, was it a star? Could they have gotten like a better, like,
thank God it was a circle.
Okay, thank God. Jeez.
It said Juden, but I.
That's where I was going.
Oh, man.
So getting into both the Friars and the Magic Castle were cool. And then the Clowns of America International.
Yeah, I mean, that's
I am officially Greenie the Clown, so that's very important.
Dude, I've got
Greenie the Clown, huh? That's what you go by?
When you sign up for Clown, well, I'll do the short version, but like I tore my one man show, which is like a magic and comedy show, and you need to have insurance for a lot of these theaters, like on your own. You need to show that you're covered, because like God forbid somebody comes on stage, trips, and then wants to sue you.
Yeah.
And the most affordable way to get insurance for your one man magic and comedy show is through the Clowns of America International.
No shit.
You join, they vet you, I guess, and
that is
you
amazing.
Give them your clown name. So I just said I'm Greenie the Clown.
I heard that like you need all clowns, like the almost like their face is trademarked too about clowns, like the smile and like how you have the eyebrows and the paint. I heard that's a trademark thing as well.
So no two
clowns are the same apparently, and that's it's all a thing.
But there's different styles. Like some do white face, like you do the white, and then some people don't, and that's like a big artistic decision.
Oh wow!
I get the newsletter, so I'm starting to learn a lot more.
Jesus,
the calliope. There was a really sad article, but it's like my favorite article I've ever read in a magazine. Okay. It was this month's Calliope, and it was all about clown safety because of all the creepy clowns
in the forest.
There's all these like murder clowns in the forest.
Oh my God.
So now clowns are getting pulled over constantly by the cops. So there's this whole like 4-page article, like don't wear your makeup, bring a check from the gig. Like you need to have proof that you're a real clown and not a murder clown.
And not in the insane clown posse.
Poor clowns. Had to like send out a news bulletin to all of the other clowns, like, just so you know, FYI, it's a very dangerous time to be a clown.
Oh man,
you know, think about the repercussions of the real clown community when you read these stories.
Did we say 2 hours, Max? Because we're gonna need.
We gotta unpack this.
This
one.
Is part one of four. This is now a docuseries.
I love the Braille Playboy.
Yeah, so
I got that on eBay.
Really?
Yeah, it was hard to find. I found out about its existence, that there was even a Playboy in Braille.
Okay.
And then I was like, I have to have one of those.
Now I'm assuming that like it's just all the articles, because how do you Braille a naked woman?
I was hoping there was just circles. I flipped through all the pages hoping there's one page with just circles, and that's what I was gonna have it open to when I framed it.
And representation of like boobs and hair.
And the crazy thing is that's really, really thick. I mean, that's
looks
like a textbook thick. And that's part three of four. In order to get in order to write one magazine worth in Braille, I would say a foot tall.
Wow.
It's a lot of work.
And it's recent too, November 2014.
And it's his Library of Congress.
Library of Congress.
Super official.
I'm a little nervous that somebody stole this from the Library of Congress. And there's some blind guy who's like, what happened?
I'm sorry.
I have one, two, and four. What happened in three?
I'm sorry.
I missed the third act.
I read it wrong. It says Library of Progress. It doesn't say Congress.
That's so crazy. That's unbelievable. There's a lot of really great things to look at.
Yeah, so you are clearly ingrained in comedy. And I will say, like, after thousands of interviews, walking into your place feels like I'm in not a museum of comedy, but just someone that's clearly driven by and passionate about all aspects of it too, not just stand up, you know, but you know, your magic show and the magic stuff you do has a huge comedy element too, which I've seen before.
Funny snacks, a magic poster over there.
Yeah. It's,
I got that when I was at Magic Camp. So I've been a counselor. I'm a camper and now a counselor at Magic Camp. And when I decided to be a comedian, I was like, I'm going to be a comedian. I just graduated college.
Okay.
And everyone's like, oh no, I don't know if he's that funny. And then between graduating and then the year after, I did 700 plus shows.
Okay.
Because I was finally living in New York. Mm. So 700 shows later, I showed up at camp. I was like, here's the act. that I've been working on and got a standing ovation crushed. Oh, and they were like, great. There was like this collective sigh from all these people who have known me since I was 12. Like, oh God, right. At least he's not throwing away his life. He's actually, he might be good at this.
That's great.
And then when I woke up, that poster was basically like outside my door.
Oh, that's great.
So the kids had made it. So it's not me saying I'm the funniest act. Right, it was like a nice gesture from the kids.
But, yeah, I mean,
so like, I have it there as like a nice positive memory.
Is it Penn and Teller, the Amazing Jonathan I see up there?
There's Penn and Teller. Yeah, Amazing Jonathan's up there. Carl Ballantine's dead now. Yeah.
Well, Amazing Jonathan's not doing too well, from what I understand, either. So
he's still kicking, though.
Yeah, he had some. He's had some really. Like,
he had a heart thing, and the doctor's like, "You have like 2 years or something, or 3 years." But that was 2 years ago. Like,
oh, really? Okay.
Wow.
He's in stoppage time.
Oh, good. Yeah,
nice. Good soccer reference there.
Well, because I know that he was like touring a little bit here and there, and I always found him hilarious.
He's performing a bunch now. His new act, he like is like, oh yeah, he tells everybody about this whole heart thing, and evidently at Magic Live, which is like a big magic convention, as he's performing, a guy dressed up as Death, like the Grim Reaper, would like try to sneak in behind him, and every time he caught him, he would go over to garbage pail, take a baby out of the garbage, stick a straw in it, and then go, and then then he would have to the Death would run away.
That
he's
is
like,
so
oh man.
Funny.
That is like such an Amazing Jonathan type of like bit. That's so funny. Ah, yeah, good times. Well, we also have like Carlin. We have Pryor.
You have all the albums in there. Oh yeah, there is one empty frame. Do we know what we're like putting in here?
It was.
Are you
Cosby
on the hunt?
Oh, okay.
Oh, it was right. Cosby.
There was a Cosby up there, and I did not feel comfortable. Especially when people come over, they're gonna be like, "Oh, he's on your hero wall."
Yeah. Oh, geez. All right.
That's what we're calling this. This is the hero wall.
Well, these are and well, Cosby actually was where Joan Rivers is. Okay. I know. I always needed a Joan.
Yeah.
And then that blank space, I never had enough. I always had seven.
Okay.
And then when I got Joan, I replaced. She replaced Bill, thankfully. Gotcha. And then people always thought that I was leaving that open for myself, as if it was like a continuation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like the metaphor. I don't think I no way belong in this class yet, but. The metaphor is kind of nice.
It's a nice metaphor. It's a nice
Absolutely.
Metaphor.
All right. So Harrison, there's a lot to, oh my God, we can go down so many paths.
I have questions, but I have a feeling if I ask you this question, it'll take up the rest of the podcast.
Go ahead. Ask it, man.
I heard you're a fan of Escape the Rooms.
Yes.
I need to know.
I've done like 60 of them.
Yeah, I've heard. Yeah. I've heard like you have a whole team.
Yeah,
I do have a team. Adventure Club.
He's practiced this question in the mirror for
the
last
month. I've heard this.
Have story. You never done it?
I've never done it. I've always wanted to do
I'm
it.
I'm like a drug dealer, but with escape rooms. I like will corner comedians and be like, have you not done this? I'm like, here's a list of the best ones.
That's so amazing.
So I've heard you've done it. So like I've always wondered like what it's about.
60 times, yeah.
I know. I've heard like there's terrible ones and there's great ones. And I've heard there's teams and like competitions.
I mean, it's like drugs. I feel like there are bad drugs and good drugs, but they're still drugs.
Okay.
It still does something to you. There's still a stirring.
So what do? You just tell people you have a cold, you got to go pick up some medicine, and then next thing you know,
like
you're in an escape the room?
It started out as just like, hey, let's go to one escape room. And then my team, but we like, we'll do four in a day.
Jeez.
And we're like, and we're very good at it because we've done so many. So normally you have an hour.
Yeah.
So we'll like call up a company. They'll build four rooms and they'll be like, we're going to do all of your rooms. We'll just book up each room in a row. So it's presumably that would take like 4 hours or 5 hours. And some of the companies are really cool about like they'll have the room set up basically as soon as we get out of one, we can go into the next one.
Oh, cool.
But we'll like take their 60-minute room and do it in like 30 minutes.
Oh, no.
And then like run to the next room.
And they're not ready. Yeah, they're screwed.
And they're just like this thing that they, but they like, it's very rare they get to see a team that like gets what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and appreciates it and like.
Yeah, we're the ad for an escape room at this point.
I was going to say.
We did a room where they took a group picture of us, and it's the Groupon picture for that room.
Oh, no way.
Is our team.
What?
So what's the team called? Super Adventure?
We're the Super Adventure Club, a.k.a. the Date Ruiners. Because there was a long period where, because we're five.
Okay.
And sometimes a room will be like, we'll sell 12 tickets.
Yeah.
And now we do it during the day, like during the week. It's very rare that somebody else is with us. But at the very beginning, we would have like a date with us.
Okay, okay.
And they've never done an escape room, and we're like veterans. So they would just kind of get a date where they get to watch a veteran escape team escape. Like by the time they figure out what's going on, we're like seven puzzles ahead. We're just like taking things out of their head. Like, oh, I know what to do with that. I'm like, but what? So we kind of ruined some dates.
That's incredible. So it's just like a, so who's on this team? Is it like,
it's me, two magicians.
Okay.
One's a mentalist. One's more classically magic.
Okay.
And a detective. Well, not a detective. He's a cop, but I want to say he's a detective. But he's a newer police officer,
okay.
NYPD.
Okay.
And then bartender, musical theater, his fiance.
That's incredible.
So
and how did this team come to be? Just like,
and it's great having
one
a
at
cop,
it. This is the one at
this
at
is the real Avengers we just described here.
Well, the crazy thing is, so that's our East Coast team.
Oh, jeez.
And then I have a buddy from Magic Camp who has a West Coast team.
Okay.
They're called the Getaway Guys.
Okay.
But we refer to them as like Super Adventure Club West and Getaway Guys East.
So you call up you call up a place and you drop your name and they're just like, oh yeah, right this way. So like, is it to that point?
They kind of know some of the designers. Like when we show up, they're like, oh, hey guys.
Oh really?
So they know, or they'll make us do like a breakdown. So we've done more rooms sometimes than the designers themselves.
Okay.
So they'll be like, how does it compare to other rooms? What would you change?
Yeah.
So we've helped some of these rooms like come up with ideas to improve their room.
You're like the hacker that gets hired by the government so they can work in security.
That's exactly what that
we
is.
Did. Like, I was just in LA literally like 3 days ago, and I did two rooms during the day. And then the night before, there was a puzzle hunt at the Magic Castle, which was amazing. It was like this guy, David Kwong, who's another Harvard guy, mm-hmm. who was also in the Harvard Magic Society.
Nice.
Which I had to like,
circle.
I brought back to life. And now I think is dead again. But yeah, I needed a hobby. I felt like I had spent literally all waking hours doing comedy and or magic, that I needed at least something that was not directly related. Mm-hmm. So
and
that's been kind of fun.
One day you're like, oh, let's go do this.
And I just did it on a whim. Like, I want to keep doing it. It's a high. It's a really
crazy
high.
How is there no documentary about this yet?
I'm sure there
should
be.
Why isn't somebody following you guys around? I mean, I guess you'll give away the puzzles.
That's the problem. If you film somebody doing an escape room, you're giving away. That escape room is over for anybody who's watched it. So there
but I think you can get away with just teasing stuff. And it can be more about what's going on in your regular life.
I'm also assuming they reset the rooms at some point, too.
Yeah, or like you find a couple of companies who are about to retire a room. You're like, do you mind if we, you know, immortalize this room before it's dead?
I love it, this room. Do you have a favorite? So what's your favorite room? What's been the room? What's the room of rooms?
Ooh, there is a room in Manhattan called the Maze of Haikana.
Okay.
It's a Russian company. The Russians are insane.
Okay,
Chinese really kind of started in New York. Like, most of the stuff was in Koreatown.
Okay.
And the Chinese came in. But then the Russians, they're insane. And they're, like, slowly taking over the market.
Okay.
And they do not care about the law.
Oh, no.
Amazing.
Oh, well, I don't want to, like, I don't want to die.
We did one where it was just two people.
What are you talking about, Matt Kleinschmidt?
But I've definitely heard of, like, people, like, where, like, you know, you might be tied up or something like that in the types of rooms, and I don't know.
We did a room from one of the Russians that was two people handcuffed, hooded.
Oh,
and
wow.
I don't know if
I'm chained into separate coffins.
Jeez.
Oh, my God.
And usually, nowadays, there's an escape button. Like, there's a red button, and if you press it, it releases the room automatically. So, like, God forbid there's a fight, red button, out.
Yeah.
So you're never actually trapped.
Okay.
But there was no red button in either of those coffins. And as far as I know, we were legitimately chained. Like, they wrapped chains around the coffin. So if there was a fire, we would have just been in our coffins.
You're done. Well, see, that I don't want to do.
Well, you're already in the
coffin,
I want to
be like, you got to do some math on a wall and pull a book and, like, a door opens. That's more my speed.
No, now it's crazy. I mean, really? We were in a room where we did all these puzzles, and then I had to climb through a vent, and I get to the end of the vent thinking it would be like another room or something.
Yeah.
And there was just a gun. And I was like, wait, what? So I come crawling out, and they're like, what's the clue? And I'm like, I just like held up a fake gun. I was like, they gave us a gun. And then this actor who was dressed, it was like an insane asylum.
Yeah.
So this doctor comes running at us. So I hand the gun to the cop.
Yeah.
So he shoots the insane doctor. And then the guy, like, quote unquote, died. We're like, what the fuck is happening? This is insane. It's getting really intense.
That sounds intense. All right, maybe
well, that's your fault, man, because people like you and your team, you know.
Yeah, we need to push
these
better
people
high
to
every
the
time
to the limit.
Do you like cheat? Do you like go in and like, oh, there's a lock over here, someone picked a lock, and like, you know, it's that kind of stuff? Or do you actually like follow the order of the room?
We try as much as we can to stay true to the spirit. Sometimes we just skip a puzzle because, like, here's something in a code, and then the next puzzle helps you find the key for that code.
Yeah.
Sometimes we just look at that code and we're like, we can crack this.
Yeah.
We don't need any more help.
Oh, okay.
So that we'll skip that. Sometimes that happens by accident.
So the clues are like guidelines, sort of, so to speak. So you can solve things without
there's so much
step by step
difficulty.
Yeah.
That some rooms, that code is just like, okay, just crack it.
Yeah.
And some rooms, like, later on, they give you an easier way to crack it. So, like, we'll sometimes beat the room because we think, oh, okay, they want us to crack it, we can do this. Even though that's not their intent.
I can see.
So it's like, you go in the room, it's like, okay, you're on the code, we'll find other shit, but if you crack the code before we get the
just give us a holler.
God, that's so
or
cool.
They just walk in with a master key and they just go, room done.
And we have this thing called a roll through, which is sometimes there's, like, number locks. Let's say there's four numbers.
Okay.
And as you solve the puzzle, sometimes they're giving you, like, here's the first number, here's the second number. Yeah, yeah. But once you have three out of the four numbers,
you
just put the first three and then you literally go 0, 1, 2. We call it a roll through. You just roll through the final dial.
Yeah.
So, oh, I'm getting all these hints.
That's a speedrunner thing. But, like, I feel like that's okay.
Yeah, like, totally. Like, it's supposed to show your smarts.
Escape the tits.
And if you just but now the room people know that. About the roll through technique. So they'll purposely give you like the first three numbers. And then when you find the final number, they'll be like, by the way, the order of the numbers is exactly 2, 3, 1, 4.
Oh, gotcha.
So you're not getting the numbers in order. You're just getting the four numbers, and the final piece tells you how to put them. So they're getting wise, which I like a lot.
So do they? So they have video cameras.
I told you to monopolize
them. No, that's okay. I'm so fascinated by this world.
I heard about it, and I was like, I gotta ask.
I feel like I just stumbled on that documentary about the mole people, you know, that live underneath the subways.
By the way,
like,
explaining and escape the room to my 99-year-old grandmother, who is a Holocaust survivor.
Oh, I can imagine.
That was a very weird and interesting process. Like, why would you do that? Like, didn't we come here to this country so you did not do that?
Wait, who's doing these rooms? The Russians are doing these rooms?
Wait, we were locked in rooms at your age? There were no puzzles. There was just death.
Oh
man. Please tell me you tell that joke on stage.
I've tried, but I think it's too dark.
It's pretty dark. But it's
a real story. My grandmother legitimately was like, I don't understand why you do this for fun.
Oh, the times, how they have changed. Wow. Yeah. Jesus. All right. Well, I'm gonna maybe we'll dip back into that because I've got more questions. But I want to get to Mad Magazine because Mad Magazine is something I hold dear to my heart. And when I moved to New York City 16, 17 years ago, it was my mission to figure out a way to either work alongside or just find my way into those offices just to like snoop around, look around. And I was lucky enough too through radio and I found my way, you know, to the offices and seen the big giant Alfred E. Newman statue.
Yeah, it's from their very short-lived movie career.
Yeah, right.
The Lampoon was killing it with all their like Lampoon movies. So Matt was like, we can do it. They made one movie.
That's it.
And then never again.
What movie was it?
It was a military camp one, I think.
Yeah, what was the... I'm trying to think of the full title.
And I love the Lampoon, but I feel like the movie quality is like falling off.
Well, the company itself, so there's like the National Lampoon name.
Yeah.
Right.
There was like some weird stock deal and like all this crazy stuff.
Keeps
where like
it owned by different people? Or?
Yeah, so then they were just like, let's just license it out and make these like straight-to-DVD things.
Yeah,
like, they're trying to revive it.
I mean, like, you know, some of those early ones they did, like Vacation and Animal House and all those.
Sure.
And those are still tied to the Harbor Lampoons. I think they're, like, residuals from that continue to fund, like, basically college student parties.
Yeah, basically.
It's incredible.
I'm sorry, Matt.
No. So it's okay. So, you know, Matt, obviously a huge part of my life. It's like I grew up in a small town in the middle of nowhere in Ohio, but we did have that convenience store that did carry Mad Magazine, and I was the asshole who folded all the back covers.
I folded many back covers.
Oh, I would very gently do it so it was like curved, so it didn't ruin the magazine, but I could see kind of what it was.
Oh, I didn't know how to half-ass anything back then. It was like committed, doing it.
Full ass of this.
Yeah. So... You know, eventually finding my way to Mad and then, you know, being fortunate enough to interview, you know, John over there and people like Al Jaffe, these legends from the magazine was such a cool thing for me. But you, my friend, were a part of it in a much bigger, cooler way. So how did you find your way through the doors at Mad?
So I was freshman in college and I was just starting to like really get into the comedy idea because basically I was doing magic, trying to be funny while doing magic. Mm-hmm. And then I had a frat brother. I was in APi, which is like the frat that made the Harvard APi. I made Facebook.
Okay.
So like when you watch The Social Network, like that's frat.
Your fraternity.
And those are the shitty parties that when I came in as a student, I was like, I'm going to fix it. So I was the first like external social chair to like, we could throw good parties. Like we're Facebook guys now.
We can do this.
And Mark came back and visited. And like, I remember having dinner with Eduardo and like, who knew that like,
yeah, of course.
What craziness was going to happen.
Changed the world.
Insane.
The
and, like,
world.
Everybody that
Not
lived
even...
with Mark and like in that frat, like has jobs. Like,
of course.
I'm always going to be like the second or third most prominent APi. There's no way I could ever be the most famous Harvard APi.
Well, if you make enough money, you just buy Facebook. And then you
I feel like Mark's billions are going to be pretty untouched.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we were...
You know him well enough to call Mark.
Yeah, Mark and A.
Mark and A.
The Zucks. no, I don't know. We would call him Zuck, but... I was like trying to figure out what I was going to do with my summer because I'd been a lifeguard. And I love being a lifeguard. But like... Harvard, there's that
pressure. We should just list off the things you don't do. Because that's going to be a much shorter list at this point. Lifeguard also now? Okay. So, I'm sorry. Lifeguard.
And then I was like, I need to do something cool. So, I just like applied on a whim to be an intern at Mad.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Which was insane. And then I planned my whole summer around it. I made sure Magic Camp was free that week. And I lifeguarded for like half the summer and then was Mad the rest of the summer. And it was amazing. It's like comedy boot camp. Like you sit down, they don't pay you, but if they buy an article, they pay you the rate they would pay any other writer.
Which okay.
is, at that time, I think it was like $500 a page, which is pretty significant. You get four pages in, like that's a pretty good deal.
That could be your rent, sure.
Absolutely. And they're really like secretly, they're training you to be a writer for them. Like their idea is by the time you get done with this internship, we want you to be somebody who submits articles to us.
Sure. By the way, that's the guy looking for the Playboy Brill cover. He's already figured it out. So
I started interning for them. That was a 6-week program. I published a couple of articles and then I would just like send them articles and I can still do that. I just like email the editors, like here's like some pitches. And if they buy the pitch, it goes in the magazine.
Wow.
It's pretty fun.
So cool, man. So obviously you have some mad stuff hanging up here as well. What's this one up in the upper right corner?
So the upper right was they were cleaning house a little bit. And when they did their old school layouts, like that's an actual, so they would take like photographs or the actual art and like kind of tape it to cardboard and be like, this is where it's got to be located. This is like pre-computer layout. So this is a layout from Mad Issue 134. Of like Al Jaffe's actually his magic. They wanted to put the cover of his magic book in the magazine.
So cool.
So it's an action. I should have taken more, honestly. Like,
yeah,
it was. They were like, yeah, if you want to take it, we're like throwing this out. So I was like, yeah, this is awesome.
Well, who throws that stuff out? You think that's such a big part of your history or like how you laid out your,
no, it's just stuff but
for
man.
Them. It's like so, they have the, this isn't the original art of the cover.
Oh, okay.
So for them, this is just like a layout of like taking up space. But for me, I'm like, this is awesome.
Yeah, this is pretty. It's behind the scenes stuff. Now, an old listener of mine from the SiriusXM days, after he retired from the military, got a job at DC Comics, and now he does all the digital covers for Mad Magazine.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so he does all the motion graphics for the digital covers.
Oh, everything. Fantastic.
So yeah, so he ended up at Mad too, man.
I remember pitching me and another intern. We had gotten together because we both love Mad so much. And this is probably 2008, I think, I want to say, around there. We came in to pitch, like, you guys should start a blog. Like, blogs are a thing. Mm-hmm. And like, unfortunately, Cracked kind of beat Mad to it, and that's Cracked really like figured out the model of it. Of but now Mad is like doing a lot more of Twitter and all that kind of content because they're really good.
Yeah, they're really
good. And they're
good.
In the office every day. So like, I remember pushing really hard. I was like, you got to get this stuff online, and like, you know, that's one. And they're doing great. Like Warner Brothers, you know, is licensing out other properties, and there's that Mad cartoon series, which is really cool. Yeah. And Mad TV came back for like half a second.
Yeah, I know. It did for a half a second. And every time I go back to my parents' house in Ohio, I bust out my Mad board game. I had Mad board game. Did you
There's
have
a card
that?
Game too.
Yeah. And the object of the game was to lose all of your money.
Yes.
And there was one space you could land on that you would acquire the Alfred E. Newman like $1 billion bill or whatever, and you couldn't ever lose it. So like you automatically lost the game if you got that bill.
Amazing.
But yeah, I still have it all the pieces and everything, man. So we bust
That's
out and we play.
That's
how
I knew about Mad was my grandmother had my dad's cardboard box full of Mad.
Oh,
and anytime
so cool.
I visited my grandmother, they would send us to the closet and I would go through it. And I would read parodies of movies I'd never seen with references I had no idea when I was 7 years old or whatever. But that was really, I remember just reading it and my dad loving it so much and then being able to call and be like, I'm writing for this magazine now.
You must have freaked out. Like,
it
did
was
you keep
amazing.
It a secret or did you wait until something happened and then you sent it to him?
Well, as like, soon as I actually got the internship and my first laptop was a Gateway.
Oh, sure.
And I remember getting like their mailing labels.
Right?
The Mad like would have these really cool illustrated just mailing labels. And I remember cutting out all the graphics to so my laptop in school was had all this Mad stuff on it.
Last time I was there, John hooked me up with the one of those old pins from like the 50s or 60s where it's like a metal circle with the stem coming up the top and you were to fold it. You know, you fold
it was
the
like,
pin
vote
over.
For Alfred.
Yeah, yeah. And he found one in his drawer. He's like, dude, this might be the last one, but it's yours. I'm like, sweet. And so
love it.
I haven't folded it or anything, but I've got it in a nice case. Yeah, it's really cool.
I remember like my first day, they were like, have you done any drugs? I was like, oh shit, they're gonna drug test me. And they're like, yeah, because if it comes back negative, we might have to fire you. And I was like, yes, this is the best place ever.
Oh my god, what a way to make someone shit their pants for a hot
that's
second.
Probably exactly the point too.
It's great. And he would like call for, have you ever been in his office when he calls for a meeting?
No, I haven't.
He has a collection of like sound effect things, like a train whistle and like weird sounds. So you'll just hear like a weird train whistle and you're like, I guess John's calling a meeting.
Oh, hilarious.
And one time I just remember sitting in a meeting and everybody's a genius, like everybody's so fast and so good at writing in that Mad voice. And just I remember looking over, I think it was Joe Raiola, and he was just like wrapping his face in scotch tape and like putting his nose into like a pig nose, and everybody like accepted it And we're just like, yeah, this is the thing that we do at meetings. And I think he was kind of doing it for my benefit and the other intern. Because like everybody else, I'm sure, has seen it a billion times. Yeah. We're like, this is literally exactly what you dream of when you picture writing for Mad, is just a guy taping his face in silence, not even bringing attention to it.
You walk in the door, the first thing you do, it's like, okay, here's your Mad-issued slinky and your Mad-issued kazoo. Let's go.
Your
like,
Band-Aids, your other things with the branded.
That's so great.
Very cool. Well, flash forward to today.
All right.
And we've been fortunate enough to catch you in a little bit of a break here. You've been on tour quite a bit. And I think the last time I saw you, I ran to you in the streets of Just for Laughs, like up in Montreal. Streets of Montreal.
My first time in Montreal.
Yeah, your first time there, and we ran into each other on the street. I was like, oh my God, we gotta hang, we gotta figure this out. And so obviously it led to this, but you've been on tour with Gad, and let's talk about this whole experience.
Sure.
And how you wound up with this guy who's now making a prominent he's putting his foot and marking his spot in the United States now.
He's making a huge dent.
Yeah,
it's pretty incredible to see how fast. I mean, it makes sense. He's maybe the most famous person in France, or the most famous comedian in France, so he has a lot of heat and skill and
sure
knows how to do
and speaks like 40 languages. I feel like his Netflix
speaks
specials
Arabic,
in like three
Hebrew,
languages,
yeah, English, French, so yeah. Four, which is, and can do comedy in all of them, which is insane.
Yeah, that's
insane.
Wow. So how'd that relationship begin? Because that's, it's not like, oh, I ran into American comic at said club in the hallway. Right. He saw me tell a funny joke. Come on the road with me.
I was just hanging out at the Eiffel Tower looking for spots.
Right.
But he was doing a documentary called 10 Minutes in America. So the initial project was, I'm going to come to, it was like Canal Plus, which is their kind of HBO. So they're like, all right, he's the most famous comic in France. This would be a fun documentary to send him to New York. Send him on a little bit of a tour to random places in America and see, can he do 10 minutes in English? That's going to be the experiment. So he comes to New York, and the first show he does is at the Metropolitan Room, and I'm hosting.
That's the old Gotham, yeah. For
well,
the people
yeah,
that know.
Gotham still owns it, if I'm not mistaken.
They do.
They do different they do. Stuff there.
Yeah, and it was a comedy show.
Yeah.
So I'm hosting the show, and Gad saw me, and we hit it off, and he saw me doing well. Like, I made sure I did a couple jokes before I brought him up.
Yeah.
And then he was like, oh, I'm doing this show at Gotham. I'm like headlining it. Do you want to host that? I was like, yeah, absolutely. So I hosted that, did pretty well. Then I made it into the documentary. Like, my favorite moment, this is crazy, was he literally goes like, they go, why are you going to New York? And he goes, because they have the best comics in the world. And then it cuts to me doing a joke.
What?
And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ.
That's amazing.
That's
man.
A nice edit.
Wait, so you can't go to France now without sunglasses and a hat.
Right. Some people, Gad will like Instagram, like live Instagram or live Facebook. Uh-huh. I'm just saying it backwards like I'm a grandmother. He has Facebook Live. So like, I did one with him recently, and he's like, who knows who this is? And then people start going, Harrison. I'm like,
Wow.
So people are following, which is cool.
It's pretty cool.
Although there was a couple of weird ones. Somebody was like, Muhammad. I'm like, I don't know if I look like a Muhammad. Seems like a weird.
Maybe he used a different filter or something when he posted that one.
So time goes by. I go to LA. I was like writing for this show for Comedy Central. I fly back. I'm getting my bags, and I get a text from Gad being like, hey, do you want to open for me at the Beacon? And I was like, holy shit. Like, he was doing it in French, but he like wanted to have an English opener. The Beacon
Weird.
Is an insane, like, my dad's a musician. He does real estate because he's Jewish, but he also plays music for fun.
What does he play?
Harmonica.
What?
It's like a blues band. So I was like, it was like a Jewish family in Long Island listening to like Muddy Waters and like B.B. King. Like, that was what we grew up to.
So what's the deal behind the Jew's harp? Like, why is it called that?
Right?
It's super weird and awkward.
Literally, anytime he plays the harp, it is the Jew harp. So he makes that a thing.
Yeah.
And the Jew harp is a particular instrument that
it's
Benjamin
very
Franklin, I think, developed
it's
or had a hand in.
It's a very specific thing. I mean, there's like one use for it. You
right.
know?
He plays the actual harmonica, although people call those harps.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's not playing the Jew harp per se, but I guess any harp is a Jew harp. But he had seen a ton of concerts at the Beacon. So like, be able to get them backstage. My parents had to see me in front of him. I think it's like 2,000 or 3,000
people.
That sounds about right, yeah.
And then he's like, yeah, I'm moving to New York. I was like, holy, oh yeah. Like, any help you want, like anytime you want to hang out, I'm in. So I did more than 30 or 40 shows with him at Joe's Pub, which was like his residency.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Including one show where Seinfeld was on the show. That was crazy. And then we went on the road together. We did 8 cities in 11 days back in like September.
Okay.
And then he kicked up this tour. So I just came from doing Portland, Denver, and Phoenix, which is super fun.
So, I mean, this is great though, because
I mean, that's crazy that like he comes from France and you're just like, up until 8 months ago, I had never heard the name. And, yeah. and I know a lot about comedy, you know, so it's just like, oh, it's very interesting. And I'm sure he's doing large size room. I mean, the Beacon equivalent of in, you know, San Francisco or wherever he's at, or Seattle. So, like, it's kind of unbelievable to see that, like, oh my gosh, this guy's known so well.
Well, I had no idea how many French and Moroccan people lived in America.
That must be what it is, I guess.
Like, you go to Phoenix, Arizona, you're like, who here's from France? Woo! Who here's from Morocco? Woo! And you're like, all of you?
That must be it.
Like, all you guys? Yeah, not that his whole audience is that,
yeah,
but, like,
yeah, but
it's, I had no idea.
That happened with Russell Peters when he did his big show. Did he do The Garden too, right?
No, but that's the example I was going to say. It's like, I'm assuming it's very similar that how Russell Peters.
He did a real huge, maybe it was Prudential Center. He did some big show on that Green Card tour. Mm-hmm. Oh, and he sold a Radio City too.
Yeah,
And you just don't realize, you know what I mean? Like, that many of whatever type of people live in the city, and they're all here right now in this room.
And he's really trying to get that American audience. So he's doing on American TV.
Well, he's
and,
doing.
Like,
he's
Carnegie
a lot
Hall
of late night.
February 11th.
He just did Conan. Was it Conan? Or
Conan twice.
Yeah, twice. Conan. Yeah, relatively quickly too. But I feel like Gad's acceptance, or not acceptance, but just rise in America is so much faster than a Peters or a Tim Minchin or some other people that are massive. I mean, he is in that documentary.
I take all the credit.
I mean, like, that's the constant here we're talking about.
But you're in the inside, so you're seeing that happen in real time. So, like, what do you think it is that people are gravitating towards, and, like, how it's able to expand so quickly?
He has a gigantic audience. Like, if you can come to America and sell a 1,000-seat theater right away, people are going to notice.
Yeah.
But he has a really smart team. He's doing a really good job of, like, you know, fresh air. Like, so many people come up to me and are like, I heard about Gad on NPR, or like, he's doing all the late night shows, and he's friends with a lot of these guys. Like, Jerry Seinfeld's a really good buddy, and he's very smart, and he's very funny. He's very good at what he does, and dedicated. I mean, not only is he working on his stand up in English, but there was a period where he was basically taking English lessons every day, working on his accent, going line by line through his scripts to, you know, make sure that he was, you know, he constantly would ask me, like, how would you say this? How would you say that? To make sure he's saying it exactly right.
Right.
And there was a period where, like, you could talk to him for, like, a very short period before he get tired, because he was speaking in a language he didn't know as well as his primary language.
Yeah, yeah.
And now he can go on for hours. That's, I mean, now he's riffing a lot more. Like, at the beginning, I felt a little bit more scripted because he was learning the language.
Yeah.
And now, because in France, he can just riff for 2 hours.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's doing that a lot more now, which is really cool to see the full Gad. Like, Gad and all of his powers. He's a great mime and a great physical person. His dad was a mime. Mm. So he has all that physicality on top of, like, great timing and charisma. And, like,
well, he must have freaked out when he met you, because clowns and magic. Yeah. And he must have been like, oh my God, you know, the son I never had.
I'm sure that's really helped for you in your career too.
Yeah.
It's been really cool.
You're being seen by so many other different people. And
definitely gets me up in front of really cool people. And it's been really fun just to, like, show him, see comedy through his eyes.
Because
for me, it's like, I'm going to the Cellar, or I'm going to the whatever club. And, like, it's exciting, but it's par for the course for a New York comic.
Mm-hmm.
But for him, he's just like, it's so cool to see a guy who does 20,000 seat arenas.
Yeah.
And I'll drag him to like a 25 seat room and be like, let's do stand up here. Or, like, we were in Boston, and, like, drag him to the studio, studio.
I can ask you.
And I'm like,
this
is the third floor of a Chinese restaurant, and, like, Gad is here.
Yeah.
And it's so cool to, like, for him, I remember him saying, he's like, this for me is way more frightening than a stadium. And this is, like, why I'm here, is to, like, do that stuff.
Yeah.
Because it makes stand-up exciting for him again.
Very cool. Well, this will be the last thing. And thank you so much for the time, Harrison.
Of course,
good to catch
anytime.
Up. Pick your brain. So you did mention The Cellar, and we've been asking a lot of comedians their audition at The Cellar and how it went, and who asked and said, hey, you know, this person's cool, just check them out, and that kind of thing. So what's your story with The Cellar?
I greenbaumed it. I feel like all of the major things I've had to, like, everybody walks through the door and I have to, like, find a window and, like, put a ladder against it and, like, climb through.
Move the gun.
My whole career was breaking and entering, is what I'm trying to say.
So and yet you're trying to escape the room at the same time. So you get in, and now you got to get out.
Climb through the window. Yeah. There's a gun in there.
Yeah. Maybe that's why I do escape the room.
Yeah.
It's like the perfect
and you're
reverse
so good at
of
it. Yeah.
Everything else that I've done.
The guy who's doing the maze backwards, right?
Yeah. I was trying to find, like, the wrecks and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then Noam, who was the owner,
really?
And a super, just a, like, an amazing guy, really, really smart too, and loves comedy. Like, it's always great when you can find an owner who, like, loves comedy and also doesn't want to do it.
Right.
Or hasn't done it. Like, is not a comic who resents the fact that he's not a comic. Noam just loves being around comedians and giving comics like a second home to work on their shit. And it's an SD too. It's such a nice thing to see that. But I emailed him, literally just like cold emailed him and was like, hey, I know you have this like radio show. And I think it was already on Sirius. It started out as a podcast.
From the table.
Yeah.
Live from the table. Mm-hmm. I was like, you've talked about every aspect of The Cellar, but you haven't mentioned, like, you haven't talked about the audition process. And right. I know it because I'm a comic, but like, I feel like your listeners want to know how do new comics
100%
do it. And if you want, I will happily be the guinea pig and audition like live on air. And he was like, yeah, if you want to do that, like, are you free like next Tuesday? It was that fast. I was like, cool. And I didn't even think it through to be like, this may be a dumb idea. Cause I show up like very excited. I'm like, I'm ready to fucking knock the set out of the park. I'm ready for this. And they're like, yeah, so like, you're not nervous? Like the fact that like this could go poorly and it's going to go around the country. Like everyone is listening to your audition. This isn't like a private thing where you can fail it and then come back.
Way to help out, no?
Yeah. Way to help out. Yeah, so they're like building. There's a couple of their comics like James Smith and Ryan Hamilton. I think Lenny Marcus was there. Oh no, Natterman was there.
Okay.
And so like they all knew me, so they were rooting for me. But like part of the thing was to increase this drama. So I'm like, oh shit, I really did. I put it all on the line for this thing. So I go down, kill it, just crush it. I found out later they were hoping I was going to bomb, so it could be like
this, more dramatic.
They didn't know who I was.
More dramatic, you know, for their podcast or radio.
Right, and Noam had never seen me before, so we just assumed I was this like random comic. And I crushed it, and then I had to come back and audition like a few weeks later for Esty. Mm-hmm. So I ended up having to audition twice. And then once Esty like sits you down, and then you're really nervous because if she hands you her email address and describes how to send in your avails, that means you've passed.
Yeah.
If she doesn't, then you haven't passed. But she's like, she has that Israeli countenance where it can be very scary and your whole career is on the line.
And she's a big gatekeeper to that career.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, Keith Alberstadt, when I was asking him about it, I was like, so like any recommendation? He's like, I don't know. But like, I was more nervous for that audition than I was for Letterman. I was like, shit.
Wow.
This is big. So that's how. And then same thing with Montreal. I never got new faces.
I know.
And I was in the final round every year.
When you told me that was you, you're like, dude, this is my first time. And you, same thing. You were just so excited to be there. Like, you're looking around like, this is so fucking great. And I'm like, man, Harrison, well, you've been here like probably 14 times. First time, I was blown away
and
when you told me that.
That was through a window because it was Gad being like, I'm doing 5 shows as part of the festival and I want Harrison to be my opener. Mm. So he was like, I'm bringing Harrison.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were like, yeah.
And they weren't going to say no, yeah.
Yeah, so that was how I got my first Montreal, you know, summer.
That's crazy, man. So obviously it went well with SD2, like that audition. You crushed it the second time.
Yeah, it was fun. It was super fun. And yeah, it's crazy to like every time you work there, you're like, this is crazy.
Yeah. Wow.
This is crazy.
There's a reason some of those magical spots, you know, there's a reason that The Cellar is the big one in New York and I guess like the store out in LA, I guess. Sure. And then you hear that. There's the lore of some of these places.
There's so much history.
So much history at The Cellar, yeah.
And like
so
the store is interesting because when you get past, you paint your name on the wall.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's that extra level of like, and also if you get your name on the wall, that means you get to park in their lot.
Really? Yeah.
So when you drive up your car, if you're on the wall, you get to hand over your keys to like an intern who's like basically a new comic.
Yeah.
And they park your car somewhere in that lot. Otherwise, you have to drive around Sunset forever.
Oh, I didn't know
that. So you really want your name on the wall because it makes your life so much easier.
Oh, I didn't know that was a thing. That's good to know. Like, as non-comics, you don't know that stuff sometimes.
So I guess we'll go out on this. The one of the final squares, the only one we didn't really talk about here, is this People magazine's Inside Comedy with Letterman.
My sister got that for me.
Joan Rivers.
Bill Murray. Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, it's from 1984. It's the cover of People Weekly. And it was like, these are literally, it says, like, if you read the article, like, these are the hot new stars of comedy.
Wow.
So it's Letterman in 84, Dangerfield, who's like just doing his big movies.
Yeah.
Joan Rivers, Eddie Murphy, and Bill Murray. They're like, these are the guys. These are going to be the guys.
This is it, everyone.
So I love having it on the wall because it's like, at some point, these were like the hot new guys. They weren't just like the names that everybody knew.
Right.
They had to have that period where people were like, you should check out Letterman. He's real funny.
That's unbelievable.
So it's kind of like,
well, it goes to show every comedian has that journey. You know, it's like I don't know of any comedian that kind of makes that jump. Some of them do. Some of them get like, you know, touched by the industry. And the next thing you know, after 4 years, they're like, you know, they're wherever they are.
But, yeah.
You know, for the most part, it takes a lot of blood, sweat and tears and shit shows near murders.
And Joan. Yeah, exactly. But like Joan and Rodney, they're all in their like 40s.
I know.
This point.
Yeah. Well, Rodney broke late, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he broke really late. And Joan, I don't feel like Joan broke that late. She was younger when she?
She was in her 30s when she really started doing it.
Yeah, she was like a housewife, and she was tired of being a housewife. Or is that the story of Phyllis Diller? I feel like that's the story of Phyllis Diller.
I think it was both.
It might be both, actually. I guess you're either a housewife or you're a comedian if you're a woman.
She'll always be Dot Matrix to me, man. Every time someone says Joan Rivers, I just think Dot Matrix right away.
I would have loved to see how she would have reacted to Trump, because she won the Celebrity Apprentice. She was very loyal to people that she liked.
That's true.
Her reaction to Trump would have been, it would have been this insane thing. She either would have done the inauguration, or she would have been like in the White House.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I feel like Joan was like a pioneer for like women's rights and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, she's just this weird juxtaposition. But then again, you have a guy like Howard Stern, who's been friends with Trump forever. He's like, hey, listen, I'm not voting for you.
Yeah.
He flat out just told us.
Yeah.
I bet Joan would be that.
Yeah, he might be.
Or Joan would try to get in the White House and like talk sense at him, because she literally would be allowed to.
Like, Donnie, we have to have a conversation.
Could you imagine some leaked footage of that? Like, just Joan having it out with Donald.
Joan in the Oval Office, like, Donald.
And he's like slouched in the office chair, just weighing in.
Just getting like, beat to death by
I will say that's another one. I'm so lucky I got to spend some time with Joan. Only once though, but we hung out for like a good hour and a half, and it was like, I knew that was a special moment. You know what I mean? That's like one on the roadmap where it's like,
it's so much pressure
telling the kids about that. Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Like, I opened for Paul Mooney for 2 years, and like, anytime you would tell me like a prior story, you're like, this is crazy.
Yeah,
like,
this guy is direct correlate. Yeah, absolutely.
You wrote for Pryor.
You were the head writer of the Richard Pryor Show. Yeah. That show's legendary.
It's crazy.
He wrote on all of Pryor's stuff, right? Did he?
Yeah, and he's like the roast master of the roast.
Yeah, he and Pryor wrote a lot of Blazing Saddles, if I'm not mistaken, too. I want to say he had a writing credit on Blazing Saddles as well, too.
Yeah.
Well, Matt, I got to say, I'm glad we booked Greeny the Clown.
I know.
The Laugh Button Podcast.
This is going to be called the Greeny the Clown episode.
But just truly amazing everything you've been able to accomplish, because you know, you're the type of person, you're like, I'm going to do this, you do it, and happens, and you, if you're passionate about something, you're gonna reach the pinnacle of whatever it is, man. So,
oh, thanks, man.
You know,
I can't wait for 10 years from now to do the next one.
Well, hopefully you'll have like
I'll fill that one up.
Yeah, maybe that'll be filled up with your vinyl, man.
Your vinyl will be up on the wall, on the spirit wall.
And I'll be telling people about that time that Harrison Greenbaum was on my podcast. It's gonna be nuts. All right, Harrison, always good to see you, man.
Thank you so much, man.
Cheers.
And that'll do it with our interview with Harrison Greenbaum on the Laugh Button Podcast.
Woo!
Yeah, we psyched. So
went by really quick.
We got we got escape the room tips, guys, that aren't leaving this room. So fuck everyone out there.
I feel like I'm a part of the elite.
So when we go to escape that motherfucking room, we're going to escape that fucking room.
The tips were directed at burning the room down. That's spoiler alert. That's how you escape it.
Hide an axe in your pocket. Knock the lock
off
the door.
Destroy the room.
So
give the guy that lets you in the room a 20 spot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So go to laughbutton.com for everything you need. We have some trailers up for the new Amy Schumer show. I mean, the new Amy Schumer movie that she's doing. We have the trailer up for the new My Brother and Me podcast, which has been turned into a CISO show. The new Detroiter show premiered two nights ago. Howlingly funny. Got to watch that on Comedy Central.
Did you howl? Literally?
Yeah, I did. I literally howled. Also, huge congratulations to our buddy Chris DeStefano, who actually had his pilot ordered at CBS. Loosely based on his life by the production team of How I Met Your Mother. And then Netflix also released a trailer for Dear White People. Coming up, we got SNL as Alec Baldwin this week. Let's see what happens. And then shout out to our previous podcast guest, Roy Wood Jr. He's got a special that's ready to premiere next week, too. So, more details on that. In the meantime, you can find us anywhere you put in the Laugh Button in the socials at thelaughbutton.com. Read up, subscribe to our newsletter, get some news reviews and interviews, buy some merch, support us.
Have dreams come true.
You can find me at I Am Kleinschmidt. Bram, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, BramFilter. And if you like Satan, go to metalinsider.net to read all about heavy things.
BramFilter, like spam filter.
Yes.
I just got that earlier today. You explained it to someone else. I was like, oh yeah, that's right. That's right.
It's nutty.
It took me a while. Brittany, where can people find you?
Twitter, it's elusive. It's spelled Beyonce, B-E-Y-O-N-C. No, I'm just kidding. Brit Brave, 1T. There you have it. Lots of tweets about
I know someone that has an Instagram handle that's like probably not Beyonce. That's their handle.
Yes, or probably Beyonce.
Beyonce.
I know who we're talking about, and I was a little upset.
It's a mutual Comedy Central friend.
Mine is Brittany the Brave, when he was interested, and it's as cheesy as you think. It is what it is.
There are those Thug Life photos of her just like as a 2-year-old. Like, yeah, what's up, Thug Life? All right, so that'll do it. Thanks for listening to the Laugh Button Podcast. Till next week. See you later.
See you.
Bye.